I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
George!
My sobriety date is January 19th, 1994. And I'm coming up on an anniversary. What it was like, I was always told to tell them exactly what happened to you. It would take hours to do that. So I'm going to tell you what it was like. It was fun. What happened? It became fun and trouble. And what it's like now, it's no more trouble. That's so for sure. It was fun. It was fun and trouble, and it was nothing but trouble before I got here. At the beginning, my family history doesn't matter. Those of you who know me, I know I was born crippled. I had physical problems from when I was born. I had two sisters. One of them was 6.5 years older than me. The other was 10 years older than me. One was very smart. The other was a tomboy. That was my normal. I had a father that worked a couple of jobs to support his family. I had a mom that was in and out of hospitals due to illness. And that was my normal. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with it. You know, the word dysfunction was a word that I didn't know before I got here, and I didn't know what dysfunctional meant. My normal was my normal, and I didn't know anything different. I wore corrective braces and shoes till I was 18 years old. I was on medications, so I knew how to abuse them at a very young age. I drank. My first drink that I remember taking is when my grandfather died. And I got drunk after they buried him because of all the insanity that my family was going through. And that was my normal. I mean, that's just the way I grew up. I was a lower middle class kid, I guess, in a very bad neighborhood. I grew up in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, for those people who know New York. Went to a Hebrew school that I cut a lot out of, you know, and I did the normal things kids did. I robbed parking meters and I played handball in the park. That was what normal kids did in my neighborhood. Cut school, got in trouble. Mom got me out of it. Dad didn't know about it, and that's the way I lived my life and as much as I can remember growing up, you know, and that was my normal, like I always said. I have incidents that I remember. I have a sister that told me the facts of life, and I was angry at my father for years because he didn't do it. And I think it was about 21 when I went to my father and said, "Hey, how come you never told me that?" He said, "I figured you'd learn the way I learned, on the street." So, you know, I couldn't be mad at my father for that kind of stuff. So this dysfunctional thing, I didn't know what that was about. And I used to say I put the fun in dysfunctional. I have two sisters. They had wonderful marriages. Neither one of them ever got divorced. I've been through two of them already, so I'm not looking for a third, thank God. And I've learned my lesson with marriages. They don't work for me. That's just the way it is. And I learned to keep away from them. And with my health, I don't think it's fair to bring what I have to the table to someone else. That's just me, you know. But I would never deny that if it ever walked in my life again. That's something I learned in here. My teenage years was a lot of fun. I was 128 pounds, maybe soaking wet. And they told me when I went to high school, I couldn't play football because I was too small. So I had to show them. So I went out and played football, became a honorable mention for all city end and corner linebacker in from Erasmus. I played a lot of ball. I was very, you know, popular because I drank a lot. I drank with the basketball team. That's what I did. So, you know, my drinking was always there. It was not unmanageable for me. It was what I used to do. I used to joke around with my English teacher because my last name is the same name of a pretty famous poet, Lord Byron, and I have the same name, last and the real name. And being this is being recorded, I won't give my last name. You guys can look it up. You know, what ended up happening is I used to meet him and said, his name was Mr. Rook. He's no longer alive, so I guess I can use his name. And I used to meet him at the bar across from Erasmus, and we used to go drink together at lunchtime. But that was normal for me, and I never saw a problem with it. Drinking was not a problem for a very long time. It was my solution. When I didn't feel good, I took a drink. And I did other substances. The substances that got me here, doesn't matter. The big book says alcohol in any form, and I've tried many, many forms of alcohol and combinations of them, and none of them ever really worked. None of them were ever with that first release I had the day my grandfather died, the first time I really got drunk and didn't want to feel. Unfortunately, I'm one of those that don't black out. I remember most of the things I've done, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It is what but that's what happened to me. My journey through high school was I was cut a lot of classes. I spent a lot of time in the student lounge. I used to save my, and I got to college. Don't ask me how I got there. I don't remember it. I used to say my majors in school were frat houses and the student lounge. That's where I did all my studying. And I was always loaded. And there was many different substances I put in with the alcohol. And none of them seemed to give me that release that was going on. And what really was is my insides, I was very empty. And I couldn't feel comfortable in my own skin. And it's the emotional feelings that I didn't know how to deal with. It was a father that worked a lot, and I thought he didn't love me. Now if I talk to my sisters, I have a whole different perspective. The big book says we drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. Although we may admit that it's injurious, after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. To us, our alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. And my alcoholic life was my normal one. I was lying, I was cheating, I was stealing. I was doing those things long before I drank, and then I drank on top of it to cover the feelings of guilt, shame, remorse. They talk about the four hideous horsemen, fear, bewilderment, terror, and despair. I lived in those things. Those are my comfort zones. So, I didn't know what to do to get out of those feelings. And the only thing that took those feelings away was me getting loaded. And I got loaded through high school, and I got loaded in college, and I got an opportunity because I was one of those. It was the 60s, and the draft was coming along, and I didn't want to go into the service. I kind of tried to lie when I was 15, and I signed papers. I signed my mother's name, and I got caught at it. And I didn't go into the Navy like I wanted to while my friends were going to the Marines. And then after that, I went the other way. At first, I wanted to join to fight for my country. Then I wanted to run from my country. I became a draft dodger after that. I was, and then I ended up breaking my knee playing ball. And I learned a whole litany of other substances that take me out of the feeling of me. See, I didn't do me very well. I don't know about anybody else in here. But me was very uncomfortable looking at me. It's much easier to look at you and complain about what you were doing or what you weren't doing. And I played victim for a long time. I share this every now and then. I was 7 years old. I bounce around a lot because that's how my head works. That hasn't changed. I was 7 years old, and I went to the neighborhood I was in. We always were taught to always help older women with their packages. And there were two women that came out of a Bohack, it was, in Brooklyn. And Bohacks, for those people who know that. It's like an A&P down here or Publix, so what ended up happening is I helped these people with their packages to their door, and when I got there, I was 7 years old. My grandfather had died. I was very disoriented from life as it was. My father was never around. My sister was playing my mother's role because she was in hospital. So that now, like I said, that's my normal. And what ended up happening is I was taking these packages for these two women, and I walked in the door, and they said, "Do you want some milk and cookies?" I said, "Sure," and then the door was locked, and they weren't women, and I was abused. I was molested, and it left a very bad scar on me. And that's the point that I believe that my world changed. I like to say my world got discolored. And what ended up happening is I felt very dirty. I felt that I couldn't tell anybody. I knew how my father's belief system was, and if I told him, he would throw me out of the house. Even at that age, I was afraid of that stuff. And I was afraid it was going to change the way I looked at life, and it did. And what ended up happening is that I kept a secret. And that secret I couldn't drink away, I couldn't drug away, and it would not go away. And I lived with that for a long, long time. And that's where it started. And, and then through high school, I became a beat up on people that were gay, and I did all kinds of things that were not nice because I just wanted to get even because I didn't feel good inside. And I figured if I beat you up, I feel better. That didn't work. So I did all the things I did, and I got through high school, and I was given an opportunity to go to work in the movie theaters. And of course, in those days, you started in the pornography field. And I started showing films on 42nd Street, and then from 42nd Street, I worked my way to the better theaters, and I ended up being the chief projectionist, I guess they would call it today, at the Ziegfeld Movie Theater. And that's a good word, projectionist, because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they used to talk about projection, and I wanted to know how everybody in this room knew what I did for a living. That's just how my head thought. My thinking is not very clear. The big book talks about a warped perception, faulty judgment, and lack of awareness is the way I put it. It talks about we didn't like to be told we couldn't control our drinking. We're in full flight from reality. We're downright mental defectives. Now, those incidents may have helped me become a mental defective, but the drinking definitely expedited it a lot. And so did the other substances I did, and I did a lot of them. So I got this opportunity to work at the airport. putting films on airplanes, and then from there I went into the movie industry, and I ended up working at the Ziegfeld Movie Theater. Now, if you know anything about it, what a projectionist does, they sit in a room about this side, they have movies running, and every so often they get up and they change from one machine to another. That's all they got to do. If the film is running on the screen, nobody knows what you do. I sat and I got loaded all day long. Word loaded, put in whatever you want, because I did most of it. Alcohol in any form, powdered and pill, it doesn't matter to me, it's still alcohol. You know, and what anything that changes me from the neck up is how I define my my recovery, my sobriety today. What ended up happening was, I did that for a long time, and I stayed on the same job for 26 years. So if I stayed on the same job for 26 years, I couldn't be an alcoholic. To me, an alcoholic was a guy who lived on the Bowery, that's where they lived. That to me was an alcoholic. I used to say I was an uptown drunk. I lived under the 59th Street Bridge. I was a little bit upper class than them. I just never saw what was really going on. I did not have a clear perception. That's where I ended up, by the way. And what ended up happening was from my drinking. At that point, I didn't lose a job, so I didn't think I had a problem. I met a girl. The first girl I met looked like my very, very first girlfriend many years before. So within 21 days, I got married. It made sense to me. She looked like the girl. Right idea. 8 years later, I got divorced. We don't have any contact today. And then I was working for the union at the same time, and I became an assistant business agent, and eventually I became the business agent of the union that I was working for, which was in the entertainment industry. And in our law office was another girl, the girl that came in, and I ran into her, and she was cute, and you had to be 21 to work in a law office in New York, so I was at the time 32, I was divorced a while, swore I was never going to get married, saw this cute girl, we got together on some powdered alcohol and regular alcohol, partying and dancing, and I made her pregnant. Little did I know how young she really was. I thought she was 25 is what she told me. Found out that she was 15 going on 16, I was 32 going on 33. I made her pregnant, and we got married. I had a wonderful son. He was perfectly healthy. And 18 months less, one day later, she had another baby. I had a daughter who had a hole in her heart, had a breathing problem. And, of course, I blamed it on all the stuff I did. She blamed it on all the stuff she did. And it was an ugly situation. And what ended up happening is I had to separate her. And there was a lot of stuff that went on in there. And the marriage got ugly. You know. And I came home 6 months later, and she was... with one of my friends, nice way of putting that. And what ended up happening is we ended up getting divorced, and I have a daughter that is going to be 27 on the 14th of January, and I have a son that just turned 28 in August. And I wanted to, after that went on, they were like 2 and 3 years old at the time, and I walked in on this thing, and I was very uncomfortable, and I went out, and that's my bottom, 1987. I like to talk about my bottom. My bottom lasted from 1987 to 1993, December 10th, we were talking about the date. Around December 10th, I decided it was cold in the streets of New York. I was living in the Bridge, I was washing my clothes in toilet bowls. I was making very good money, but I refused to put money into rent. I wasn't seeing my children. We were separated. We were going through a divorce. And life was miserable. I wanted to die. And I just couldn't die. And what ended up happening was my daughter and son, I was supposed to pick them up. I didn't show up. She was supposed to have me come and get them. She wasn't there. And my kids became pawns. And I always tell the story of my daughter running out in the street. She was about 2 years old. And I remember hitting her. The day I hit her that day, I always, it's in a letter I wrote to her. I didn't hit her, I hit my ex-wife. And all the anger I had came out on that kid, and I said, I can't see these kids anymore, and I stopped seeing them. And I'd like to say that, from 1987, everything, I stopped seeing my kids. I didn't talk to my ex-wife. My mom didn't know if I was living or dead. Those two sisters, I didn't care what was going on. Around 1993, around that time, my older sister was having her 25th anniversary. I was supposed to come down to Florida. They sent me money for a ticket. I always complained I had no money while I was making about $2,200 a week. And I was telling them I had no money. They sent me a plane ticket. Of course, I didn't come down here. I used it for other things. And what ended up happening a couple weeks after that wedding, that anniversary I didn't go to, my sister died from cancer. They opened her up. They closed her up. She was died in a very short time. My other sister wasn't talking to me. My mother didn't know if I was living or dead. My kids didn't know where I was. And I had an ex-wife that was drawing me in and out of courts. Then they couldn't find me because I was living on the streets. That's where I ended up. I ended up under that 59th Street bridge. And I would change jobs when they got too close to finding out where I was. And that was my bottom. In December of 93, that ex-wife of mine married the guy that 8 years later she started seeing. 8 years prior she started seeing. I decided I wanted my kids back into my life. I did not come into recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I came to get my kids back and deal with my ex-wife and my friend at the time who was fooling around with her. That's how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really came in not even for that. I came in because it was cold in the streets of New York in this time of the year. So December 10th, I decided, that's around when she got married, I decided I was going to come in from the cold. So I went to a program, an employee assistant program that I started 5 years prior for people who had a problem. See, I didn't think I had a problem. Here I am again with my thinking. It shows you that sharp mind of the alcoholic. I went to this person, her name is Jean Mertz. We still are in contact today, and she's a proud member of Al-Anon. And we sat down, and I told her about this guy and all the things this guy did from the 60s where I worked. I was a roadie. I did a lot of different things in my life. I worked for Sears. All this stuff was stuff I did, but it's also defined who I was. What I did is who I became. Who I hung out with is the personality I took on. I never had my own individual personality, and that kept me sick for a very long time. I didn't deal with the things that happened to me as a child, and I had a lot of secrets, and I believe today that you can't stay, look good on the outside and be dirty on the inside. And I was very dirty on the inside, and I didn't know how to clean it out. And I was afraid to tell anybody because I was afraid nobody would like me and nobody would want me around, or that people would tell me to leave. So I was living with this stuff for a very long time. And I decided to go to a treatment center, and I didn't decide to go to a treatment center. I decided to go to this employee assistant program, and I told her about this person who did all this stuff, and they said, bring him in. So I said, oh, we made an appointment for him to come in. Didn't know she was sitting talking to me all the time. And I came in, and she says, where's this guy? I said, he's sitting next to you. She says, you? And I said, yes. And that shows you how well I cover my addiction, and some of us can cover our addiction. And I didn't realize how well I was covering it. And what ended up happening is we had a choice. I could have stayed in New York and then go to Connecticut or gone to a place upstate New York. I decided I wanted to not stay in New York because people were looking for me. Some of their last names ended in vowels, so I didn't think I belonged hanging around New York City too much. And also I decided to split town. So when people say geographicals don't work, that's not my experience. My experience, it worked real well for me. I went upstate New York to this place, and the guy who was my counselor when I got there, he was an old biker. He had no teeth, pretty much like I came in. He had no teeth in his mouth, and he came in there, and I was a smart ass then, and I told him right off the bat. I walked into my first group late, and he said to me, what do you want to do, run this group? He said, here's my badge. I said, good, now get out. Wrong thing to do. And he became a friend of mine. Carl and I are still friends 18 years later. Wonderful man. He helped me with my recovery more than anybody else. He sat in front of a bathroom door, and he told me to open the door, and every time I opened the door, he closed the door. And then I'd open the door, and he closed the door. And finally, I stood by the door so he couldn't close it. He said, you finally learned how to make a decision. It didn't make sense to me at that time. And he asked me to read step 10 in the 12 and 12 and saw what I can get out of it. There's a part in the 12 and 12 in step 10 that says, someone who knew alcoholics well once remarked that pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. We had to know the pains of drinking before sobriety and emotional turmoil before serenity. I'd like to say I understood it when I read it, but I didn't. That took many years for me to understand that every time I grow, it's usually through pain. It's either emotional, physical, or spiritual pain, and I grow through that. Today I know that. I didn't know that then. I just knew that that made sense to me, that I was in pain and I just wanted to grow. I wanted to get out of the pain. So I was given an option when I left that treatment center to either go to Arizona or Florida. So I chose Arizona. You see where we're sitting, guys. We're in the state of Florida. And the reason I didn't want to come to Florida is because my mom was here. And I figured if I was the other side of the country, I wouldn't have to deal with that issue. So I came down here and I was sent to a little halfway house that's right around the corner. In that time, that was the only part there was right around the corner. And when I got there, I can tell you about my 38 hours from hell. I always talk about my bus ride down here. They took three people off of the bus, one for smoking an illegal substance, three or four others for drinking on the bus. And there was a young lady that came over to me, and she said to me, "You and a friend of Bill?" I said, "Bill who?" I was after 30 days of treatment. I didn't even know who Bill Wilson was. And she said, "Well, you're in a 12-step program." I don't know. I just graduated from so-and-so. Graduated. She sat down with me. She was an adult child of an alcoholic. And from Fairfax, Virginia, all the way to Tampa, Florida, she 12-stepped me. She talked to me about recovery and about the program. That's my first angel. That's actually my third angel. My first angel was Gene Mertz. My second angel was Carl. And my third angel was this woman who I never met again. And she sat with me, and then I got down to Florida, and I get off of the bus, and there's nobody from this halfway house to meet me, so I have to go ask the one person I don't want for help, and that's a cop. So I asked this cop for help, and the cop turns around and knew exactly where it's going. I didn't have my ticket. I was so clear when I left my treatment center. I wrote that I was leaving the place I was going to and going to the place I was leaving. So my luggage made it halfway down to Florida and then went right back to where I came from. And I don't try not to mention names that are traditions. So I got here with no luggage. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know the name of the place I was going to. And the first guy I got to ask for help was a cop. If you're like me, you don't ask cops for help. And as soon as I said I needed to go to this place, he knew exactly where it was. Well, when they saw me get out of the back of a police car, they didn't want to let me in. So I had a fight to get into a halfway house while I was down here. And I'll tell you, that halfway house did a lot for me. That's my experience with it. And what ended up happening is I used to walk to a meeting every day because I was too proud to ask anybody for a ride. I was too proud to tell anybody I didn't have a car. I lost my driving privileges in the state of Florida. Never had a DUI, never had a speeding ticket. I had a very clean record. I had a fight with the state of New York over child support, which I didn't even know, which took 14 years to straighten out. So my first 6 years of sobriety, and some people who know about my little scooter, my little skateboard, I started off first with a bicycle that somebody stole, and I had one of these go boards at 44 years old. I'm on one of these putt-putt boards, and I used to go everywhere with it. I go to Fort Lauderdale with it. I didn't have a license, and I couldn't get a license. And then I graduated at 4 years of recovery from that skateboard to a little 49cc scooter. And then I got stopped by the cops. Now, I got a job, and when the cops stopped me, they told me to go to the court, then they told me to go down and get a license, and I went to the Motor Vehicle Bureau, and I got my license. Nothing was on record. God even fools the Motor Vehicle Bureau, I like to say. I got my license, and I've had one ever since. And where it went, all the problems I had all disappeared, just like that. And maybe because I was doing the right thing for that time. I don't know. I don't even try and figure that one out anymore. I got down here, and I was doing everything I was told to do. I found the guy I wanted to be my sponsor, and he was a big guy. His name was Bob Welch. He's the man who carried the message to me. They used to call him Kmart Bob. Kmart Bob used to have a 10 o'clock meeting, and he used to say at a meeting place up here, and he used to say, "George, I want you to get here early, and I want you to save this seat for me, long table." And he used to say, "Save this seat for me." And then I'd get there, and I'd save the seat for him. Then he said, "I'd like to get you here early, and I'd like you to stand at the door and say hello to everybody." And then after that, it was make coffee. And then it was set up the chairs. And slowly but surely, I was doing, I like to say the ABCs, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs, is how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm real grateful for my sponsor. And this is what started happening. That's what it's like. That's what happened. And it's what it's like. The process of my recovery was wonderful. This man spent time speaking with me and spending time with me. And I was going to ask him to be my sponsor. He was a very big, brawling man, and there was two guys fighting that day, and he grabbed one in one hand and one in the other, and I don't want to mention the name of the guys. Well, both of them, he picked them both up, and he said, "You're not going to fight in front of me," and put them down, and I said, "I can't ask this guy to sponsor me. He'll kill me." You know, I was like 120 pounds. So I decided that, you know, I was going to ask, and I went to him, and he spoke to me every day. I was his project, and I was getting to get thrown out of the halfway house, and they said, "You need a sponsor." I went, and some guy was telling a story on a Saturday night, on a Friday night at the room, and I turned around and I said to him, "Would you sponsor me?" He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, if I don't have a sponsor, they're throwing me out tomorrow." And he, every Tuesday, would come and pick me up, and we'd go to Denny's, and we'd read the Big Book. and the 12 and 12, and I went through the steps with this man. And at the same time, Bob was always there. And Larry S. became my sponsor, and Larry took me through the steps and got me involved in the book. And Bob used to talk about life, and that was what I did. Every Thursday night, we went out for pizza, and we talked about life. My journey through this program was about staying involved in the program. It was a wonderful journey. I had wonderful people around me. I was about 6 months sober, and I walked out of an AA meeting, and I was served with papers to give those children up that I came into AA for. Meanwhile, my ex-wife wouldn't let me talk to them. I could tell lots of funny stories about what happened at the halfway house with me when I was talking to my wife on the phone, and somebody slammed it down, and they locked me in a dog cage. I mean, I have some funny stories. The people who know me know those stories. But it wasn't funny to me when I walked out of a meeting and my children were being pulled out of my life. And I didn't know what to do. And I went to my sponsor and he said, well, I know how to give my children up. I need you to go check out with some other people. And one of those people is a guy by the name of Ben T. And Ben asked me, what kind of custodian were you to those children? And I said, well, I gave her this much money and I gave her a car and I did this. And he said, I didn't ask what you did for them. I asked you what kind of custodian you were. And the big book talks about a jumping off place, and I'm going to stop at that moment. My jumping off place didn't happen before I got here. My jumping off place happened at 6 months of sobriety, where I wanted to go out and use more than anything else in the world. And I was doing steps, and I was involved in the program, and I didn't know what to do. And Bob was talking to me, Larry was talking to me, and Ben was talking to me, and I didn't know what to do. And he said, you know, you can do, what kind of custodian you were? And I said, I was an absentee father. And that was very emotionally painful to me because that's what I believe my father was. I became my father is what I used to say. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's my truth. And that's the thing I've learned, that my truth isn't always the truth. I have to find the truth. And the truth was that I wasn't a good custodian to my children. I was absent. My wife had every reason to behave the way she did in trying to keep me away from them. I see that today. I didn't see that then. All I knew, I was angry, I was frustrated, and I wanted to get loaded. I didn't drink that day, and I came back the next day, and I talked to Ben, and I talked to Bob, and I talked to Larry. I had three people working on me, and then they suggested I get together with some of the women. And one of the women suggested, Kathy R., her and a woman who became my AA mom, suggested that I go down to the beach with two pillows and give my children a God. Well, God and I weren't talking. So why would I give my children a God? So I didn't know what to do with that, you know, and I struggled with that for a while. And for a whole year, I had to make a decision. And I came up with a decision that I finally made, like my third step, it took me a long time to get there, was what would be best for my children? And what would be best for my children at that time was for me, because I could not take care of them in the manner they needed to be taken care of, was to let them go. Very painful for a father to do who loves their children, and that's why I came in here. But it was also one of the best things I have ever done. It was the biggest act of love that I could have ever given. Didn't know that at the time. And I like to say my kids came right back and my life got good. That's not my experience. I will tell you that my first couple of years was a struggle medically. In year six, I came down with hepatitis C and cancer, and I cut my hand off. It was reattached. I was told that I had not much time to live. And that was from year six and a half to year 10, all I did was medical. It's the only way I know how to say it, real tough medical. Didn't think I was going to be here. I was able to get back with my mom and be of service to her and help my sister that didn't talk to me my first 2 years of recovery. Healing started to happen. I like to go through the steps at this point real quickly of how I saw them when I came in here. The first step said, you know, I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. Well, I didn't believe I was powerless over alcohol. If you only behaved the way I wanted to, my life was quite manageable. Staying here for a little while, I realized that even when you behaved the way I wanted you to behave, I would change the way I wanted you to behave. So my life was very unmanageable. There were a lot of powers greater than me in the second step. Came to believe the power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I didn't think I was insane. We were joking around before the meeting. I thought everybody here was insane, and I was perfectly okay. You guys just didn't understand. There was no third step in my life. I was not making a decision to turn my will and life over to care of God, because God and I wasn't speaking since I was 7 years old, and I wasn't going to start now. There was no moral inventory. I lived on the streets, so there was no morality. in the fourth step. I was not telling God. I was not going to tell you what was going on at that point. I was too afraid. And I sure as heck was not going to admit to myself all the stuff I did. So there was no need for a fourth step or a fifth step. And I came to the sixth step. I didn't think I had any character defects. I thought you guys were all defective. So I didn't need a sixth step, and I wasn't going to get on my knees and ask God to remove what I didn't have. I liked the eighth step. I made a list of everybody that screwed me over, and in step nine, I was going to wait for you to come and tell me how sorry you were. And in step 10, I took everybody's inventory when I got here. I still do. I just don't tell you anymore. So I had a lot of fun with the 10th step. And the 11th step, I didn't have any prayer and meditation in my life, and I had no message in step 12. I say that because that's how I saw the steps, and that's what I believed is my truth when I got here. Through the process of sponsorship and loving people in my life, I started doing the work that was laid out in the big book. I was at that jumping off place I talked about again and with 6 months of sobriety, and I went after my sobriety the same way I went after my alcohol and my drugs at that point. And what ended up happening was I admitted that I was not only powerless over alcohol, I was powerless over people, places, things, and situations that I never even knew was in my life. And I had to live and let live. Things, the little slogans came real handy at that point. You know, and today I know that that's still to be true. I'm a lot more manageable in my life. I still have a lot of areas that have need work, but I'm not afraid to look at them anymore. I love the second step today. I also love the six traditions. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My powers were money, property, and prestige. Those were the powers I believed in when I got here. I did not understand that those were the things that diverted me from a relationship with a God that you guys introduced me to. I got to that third step with a man on July 4th of 1994, outside of a church right around the corner here. On the third step of that church, I sat down and I prayed with another man for the first time. And when we got done, he said to me, "Are you willing to turn your will and life over to the care of God?" And I said, "No," because I wasn't. And he said, "Well, are you willing to turn your will and life over to the care of the steps?" And I said, "Yes," because I was. And that's what we did. That was my decision in step three. Somewhere between three, when I made that decision, somewhere between that fourth step and that 10th step, I found a relationship with a God of your understanding, not of mine. And eventually, then it was a God of my misunderstanding. And today, I have a wonderful relationship with a God of my understanding. You know, so I did that, and I did my immoral inventory the first time. Today, I take moral inventories. As a matter of fact, I'm going away on a spiritual retreat next week and weekend, and I'm going to do all 12 steps over the weekend. I've already had that set up for me. That's what I do on my retreats, once a year. And like I said, my anniversary is coming up. I go that annual house cleaning that the 12 and 12 talks about. So I got to that fourth step at that time. I sat down with this man and I told him everything. And I'm not going to talk about the blockage in the fourth step that I had. I like to call it a pen light step. If you don't pick up the pen, you'll never see the light. It's really that simple. How you write it doesn't matter. There's only one wrong fourth step, the one you don't write. That's as simple as it is for me. Whatever works for you, let it flow. Do it once, do it 10 times. You know, that's individual. I don't get into that controversy that I hear all the time. It's a tradition. That's why I don't do that. So I did that fifth step. I didn't know what my character defects were. My sponsor was kind enough to tell me what they all were. Made a whole list for me, and he told me, stop doing what's wrong for me in step six, and in step seven, start doing what's right for me. I made that eight-step list again eventually, and then I did my ninth step to the best of my ability at the time. I like to say, by the time I got to step nine at a year, when I was almost a year sober, I finished all 12 steps. I like to say my kids came back in my life, and my life was grand. That didn't happen for me. It's not my experience. I did that 10th step. I still write a 10th step pretty much daily. I'm just one of those that's so anal in some of the things I do. That's how it works for me. So I write a 10th step daily. I practice a lot of prayer and meditation. I'm speaking to God all the time because without me speaking to God, I can't improve that contact. And I need God in my life more now than I ever did when I got here. And I didn't realize how much he was part of my life. Carrying the message, we do it for three reasons. We do the fifth step for three reasons. There's three parts to the 12th step. I would believe we do the fifth step. We go to God for forgiveness. We go to ourselves for understanding. We go to another human being for humility. And in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, I had to do all the steps to get that awakening. we carry the message to alcoholics. And I like the way Al-Anon says it to others, especially alcoholics, because it don't have to be an alcoholic, the message of hope that we can carry to other people. And we practice these things in all our fears, not the ones I choose, all of them. That's where I have a problem. I fall short like any human being. My experience has been that I had to do traditions because that's the way I was taught. And I stayed pretty centered in the group. I like to talk about what happened in year 14. I'm coming up on year 18 now. In year 14, on January in that year, I get a phone call from a place I used to work at that they had a phone call from someone named Cassie, which is my daughter. She wanted to get in contact with me. I spoke to her. I got contact with her. We have a wonderful relationship. It took 14 years before I made contact with my daughter. And since year 14 to this day, we speak at least two or three times a month. I'd like to say the same thing happened with my son. We don't speak at all. I have an ex-wife that I call regularly. She sometimes calls and sometimes don't. The sometimes she calls is usually when she needs something. And that's and I have no problem with that. I've learned to live and let live. But my daughter and I have a wonderful relationship, something that I gave up on in probably year 7 or 8 that I was never going to happen for me. It may happen for somebody else, and I was okay with that. And God restored that relationship. Just because I'm ready doesn't mean God's ready to give it to me. And I've learned that truth today. I would like to say that, you know, in year 15, my life was okay, and all of a sudden, I couldn't breathe one day, and I went to the hospital, and that kept me on a new journey in health. From year 15, I was downstairs, and I was on my way up from the emergency room, and one of the guys in this room was standing by my bed with 5 other alcoholics to have a meeting at 10 o'clock at night. And we had a meeting right as soon as I got in the hospital. And for the next 15 days, that room was filled with people from Alcoholics Anonymous. Constant meeting after meeting, nurses, doctors, people I haven't seen in 15 years were showing up. I called somebody up and said, I think I'm dying. They said, why? I said, all these people in my past are coming to see me. And then the man says to me, well, maybe God has shown you how much you loved. See, my perception is not always what's going on. And I'd like to say that I got well real quick. I am now going into year 18, and I am still struggling with my breathing issues and other health issues. But I'm coming to the other side of that dark tunnel again. That's the second time in my recovery that people didn't think I'd be around. So God fools the medical profession too. So I have a wonderful God that gives me these things, and I know why he gives me these things today. Because through the cancer, through the hepatitis, through the chronic pain, through the illnesses, I was able to start a meeting at another group to help people get through terminal illness, people who are going to die. And that meeting has been going on for about 8 or 10 years now. And it started through another book, which uses AA, and it doesn't matter the name of the book, but it uses our 12 steps to deal with illness. The same way I use the 12 steps to deal with everything else that goes on in my life, these 12 steps work all the time, working in any area of my life. So the gratitude I have for this fellowship at this time of the year is remarkable, because December of 1993, under that bridge, I cut a cardboard box. I cut a hole in it. I went and I stole some battery-operated lights, and I sat there looking at lights with a bottle and all other kinds of substances and tried to die, when 8 blocks away was Rockefeller Center. See, I don't see things very clearly. The sharp mind of the alcoholic had me in such a prison, and in the prison I could not break. And I came in here, and the people showed me a path to break that prison. So my gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous can never be repaid. It's a new year. It's a new beginning. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have a new life. Thanks for letting me share.